Okay, our next and final presentation this morning is called The Status of Adolescent Sexual Health in the United States, the Impact of Abstinence Only Until Marriage Programs. And this talk will be given by Catherine Morrison. Catherine, or Kate Morrison, is the State Policy Coordinator at SECIS, the Sexuality Information and Education Council of the United States. Kate plays an integral role in developing SECIS's state-based work, providing technical assistance to state and community-based partners, and developing the SECIS state profiles. Prior to joining SECIS, Kate completed her Master of Public Health at St. Louis University in Health Policy. Kate has worked on numerous campaigns, including Senator Tom Daschle's. In college, Kate served on the local Planned Parenthood Board of Directors, earning the Hope for Humanity Award in 2004. She graduated from Bradley University with degrees in political science and women's studies. Kate?
Good morning. Can everyone hear me? All right, I like the setup. So I noticed a few faces from yesterday, so I apologize. You're going to hear a few things that you heard yesterday. Again, I'm from SECIS in D.C., and I'm an advocate. So I'm going to tell you about abstinence only until marriage programs, where they came from, how long they've been here, and then I'm going to get into our annual publication, the state profiles, and our findings from this year, and then end on a positive note. So first of all, a quick definition of what comprehensive sexuality education is. It emphasizes abstinence, includes information on contraception, is medically accurate and evidence-based. It also includes information on personal relationships, communication, and decision-making. I think we all know what comprehensive sex ed. The politics of this is there's not one single federal dollar dedicated to comprehensive sex ed. Instead, we fund abstinence only until marriage programs. And there are three funding streams to fund this. The thing that I want everyone to walk away from here is that these programs are not new. Our opponents like to say, oh, we haven't had enough time to evaluate our programs. Not true. President Reagan actually started this trend back in 1982 with the Adolescent Family Life Act. AFLA is funded at $13 million annually. It was originally called Chastity Education. And, yeah, Chastity Education. Nice, right? And it was really designed as a counter to the family planning program. It's still funded at $13 million. It's kind of small potatoes compared to the next two programs I'm going to tell you about. So fast forward to 1996, welfare reform. President Clinton is trying to get his welfare reform bill in, and Newt Gingrich is in charge of Congress. And conservatives are trying to think about ways to keep women off of public assistance. So this is where we got abstinence education and the first federal definition of it. And the concept here was really to promote marriage and to family households to keep women off public assistance. And so this is a block grant. It goes to the state, and then the money is distributed from there. So it's different from the other two programs. It's $50 million annually divided between the states. And this is the first time we see this eight-point definition. At first, states could only address one of these. The definite, it has now changed. You have to meaningfully represent all 8 points. Point B, abstinence from sexual activity outside of marriage is the expected standard for all school-aged children. That a mutually faithful monogamous relationship in the context of marriage is the expected standard of sexual activity. And make no mistake, when they say marriage, they mean a heterosexual marriage between a man and a woman. So keep going. Sexual activity and outside the context of marriage is likely to have harmful psychological and physical effects. My boss always says that if this were true, we'd be a nation of lunatics. Because the fact is, 95% of Americans have sex before they get married. F, I don't have this bolded, but teaches that bearing children out of wedlock is likely to have harmful consequences for the child, the child's parents, and society. So really, these eight-point definitions of abstinence education, air quotes are important here, it's really about marriage promotion. And like I said, at first when Title V came around, Title V abstinence only until marriage came around, you didn't have to meet all 8 points. You could just do point G, teaching young people how to reject sexual advances when they use alcohol. But now you have to, quote, meaningfully represent all 8 points. And it's really turned into a marriage promotion industry. So fast forward now to 2000, and President Bush is here, and he loves abstinence programming. It is his baby. And so he created CBAE, and this is the largest funding stream. It started off at $20 million a year. It's now funded at $113 million. He keeps asking for more money. We keep telling him it doesn't work. So thankfully, the Senate has stopped this. So. These funds are awarded directly to the state level, to the community-based organization. So the research is very clear. The Waxman Report really started it. Henry Waxman is a great advocate for us, Congressman Waxman. Mathematica and Emerging Answers, which Carla spoke about. It's not on the slide. I'm embarrassed because Dr. Kirby is here at this conference. He's a great advocate for us. So we know the research is clear, and I have a handout here about what the research says from CECAS, that abstinence and contraception, comprehensive sexuality education, is better at making kids be abstinent. So I didn't say that clear. But if you want kids to be abstinent, teach them comprehensive sexuality education. It's better at delaying the onset of intercourse, reducing the frequency of intercourse, and when they eventually start having sex, they're safer about it. So the evidence is pretty clear. All right, I'm going to go on to the state profiles. This is my baby that I spent a lot of time working on. And every year, CECAS tracks this money. Obviously, it's a bad thing, and we want to see what's going on with it. It's $176 million each year, and it's divided between the states. We look at where the money's going, what they're doing with it in all of the states. And in fiscal year 08, we'll also be looking at the territories beyond the District of Columbia. So we'll be looking at Puerto Rico and Micronesia and Guam and the Virgin Islands. So there's a lot of other places where this money is actually going. It's kind of scary. But I'll talk briefly about the methods. We talk directly to Title V, abstinence only until marriage coordinators on the state level. We do a lot of Freedom of Information Act requests. These applications that they submit to get the funding to the federal government are actually kind of scary, full of, they're not the same quality that we would expect from ourselves, I would say. And you can find them on our website, CECAS.org, under Policy and Advocacy. So they look like this, and then underneath here you can find your state. And so there's a lot of components to the state profiles. I chose my home state of Illinois here. The top component, the thing that we're really trying to track is how much money goes into each individual state. You see in Illinois, we get over $8 million that goes into abstinence only until marriage programs. We look at law and policy funding, and then the funding chart is what a lot of our advocates use. So I want to talk about what we really found in the fiscal year 2007 profiles. And we always do it a year in reverse because of the way the federal government actually funds the grantees. First of all, the biggest funding trend is that 25 states are no longer participating in the Title V abstinence only until marriage program. And this is really exciting. If you live in the Northeast, on the West Coast, or in a few Midwest states, you're likely to live in a state that does not participate in this program. And 80% of the states have left due to the strong evidence. They say, thanks, but no thanks. And it's really exciting, and we are seeing the states help us move towards a paradigm shift away from the abstinence approach, and I'll speak about that more later. And just a quote, why would we spend tax dollars on something that doesn't work, that doesn't make sense to me? Philosophically, I'm opposed to spending government dollars on something that's ineffective, that's just irresponsible. I don't know if Ned knows, but I use this picture quite a lot. And I love using Colorado because it's not a blue state, it's not a red state, it's just a state that says this is a waste of our money. And there's actually a very large abstinence only until marriage industry leader in Colorado that's in the Department of Health every single day saying, take this money again. And they're saying, no thanks. So another funding trend that we see that's very disturbing to us at CECAS is that a majority of the funding, there's a total of $176 million that goes out every year. And something I failed to say, in the last 25 years, that's a total of $1.5 billion. So wasted money. But each year, $176 million, half of it goes into the southern states. The southern states are 16 states plus the District of Columbia. And so we see that most of it goes into that area. Only one of those states has actually opted out of the Title V abstinence-only until marriage program, and that was Virginia in 2007. Governor Kaine did make that decision based on the sound evidence against abstinence-only until marriage programs. And I just wanted to also show, even within southern states, we see that it's concentrated in certain places. So Texas, Mississippi, Georgia, Florida. And I don't have any specific information up here about health disparities, but we also know that in the southern states, we see the highest rates of teen birth rates, some of the highest rates. So other states with top funding, New York, Ohio, Illinois, California, and Pennsylvania. And the thing that's interesting about this is that the only state participating in the Title V program here, the Title V abstinence program, is Illinois. So CBAE really has the strongest influence. They are huge grants, million-dollar grants over 5 years, and these organizations just prop up because there's CBAE money available. And we're doing a much better job of tracking that in the fiscal year 08 profiles, which will come out in February. Another funding trend are crisis pregnancy centers. In fiscal year 07, we tracked 34 crisis pregnancy centers receiving nearly $14 million in abstinence-only until marriage funding in about 23 states. So in the Title V program, Title V abstinence-only until marriage program, it was about $3 million. So if you think about the fact that 25 states are out of the program and they only distributed about half of the money, 3 million of it went to crisis pregnancy centers. And if you don't know what a CPC is, it's a pseudo health center that's not really designed to do abstinence education, abstinence program. It's designed to dissuade women from having abortions, and that's absolutely what they do. And then the other funding all came out in CBAE grants. And if you're more interested in CPCs, there is a great article in Ms. Magazine for this one that just came out. We also track law and policy. We've seen a lot of movement on the state level in the last year. There are 20 states plus the District of Columbia which mandate sex education be taught. We saw a little bit of movement in that. California updated its standards. It's not mandated, but they did update it. If you teach it, it has to be comprehensive. The District of Columbia passed new standards, and it is comprehensive, and they are mandated. So we saw some excellent progress. But right now, we only have 6 states plus D.C. which mandate comprehensive sexuality education. And these are the states. And then we broke it down a little bit, because at CCAS, we have a specific interest in where the money is going and what the law and policy looks like. So if you look at the 16 states plus D.C., which are considered southern, and what the law and policy is there, in those states, 8 of them plus D.C. mandate sex education, but the range of law and policy that is mandated is quite wide. So D.C. and Delaware, their laws are comprehensive, so they include abstinence and contraception and all that stuff, so we would consider them very good laws. But the other laws that are being mandated in southern states are really abstinence-only until marriage. They're not really what we call sex education. They are mandated to teach young people the benefits of abstinence-only until marriage. South Carolina is particularly intriguing to me because they are required to teach young people that marriage is the best option, but they are not mandated to teach HIV or STD prevention, HIV, AIDS prevention at all, and all the other states in this list do teach about HIV and AIDS. Just a real quick comparison, 34 non-Southern states, 12 do mandate sex education, 5 are comprehensive, and then of the 7 states not included there, only 1 does this mandating of abstinence only until marriage. So it really is something that is particular to Southern states. There's a lot of pending legislation going on around the country, which we talk about in the overview to the state profiles, to funding bills, which are very similar to our REAL Act on the federal level, the Responsible Education About Life Act, which would provide the first ever funding stream for comprehensive sexuality education, would provide grants for organizations or schools or anyone who wanted to do comp sex ed, evidence-based sex ed, of course. If then, in Florida, the Healthy Teens Act says if you teach it, it must be medically accurate. And a mandate. Minnesota's been working I believe for 9 or 10 years, to pass the Responsible Family Life and Sexuality Education Programs Act, which would mandate sex ed in grades 7 through 12. One last thing that we track in the state profiles is what programs are being used. The abstinence-only until marriage industry that has developed has produced a series of curricula. Choosing the Best, AC Green's Game Plan, and Weight Training are three of the most popular programs, and they've been around for a long time. When this money came about, these curricula also started developing. And CECAS has tracked them and reviewed them for the last 15 years. And we publish these on our website, communityactionkit.org, and they have actually improved their medical inaccuracies over, these are like the fifth or sixth versions. What we're seeing, unfortunately, is the development of regional curricula that are starting where these are where the Choosing the Best, the largest ones, also started with. So the regional curricula, such as HIS, Healthy Image of Sex, they have those medical inaccuracies, the just blatant misinformation, and are medically inaccurate. They all contain gender biases and misinformation about sexual orientation and those kind of things. Moving forward, 25 states out of the Title V Abstinence Only Until Marriage program is a great step forward. We had our first congressional hearing on abstinence only until marriage programs after 25 years. We had been waiting for a while, and that was a great success. And we're talking about comprehensive sex ed in a way that we never have before. John McCain attempted to do a campaign ad. I don't know if anyone heard about this. Well, he tried for like a day, and it was so false. He was making some claims about a piece of legislation that Senator Obama supported, but it was so false that no one believed it, and it was pulled down right away. So people just don't believe these things anymore. It's also part of the Democratic Party platform, and that's very exciting. The state profiles show us that we are shifting away from the abstinence only until marriage approach in some states, but we still have a lot of work to do in particular states. So we will eventually get rid of this bad funding. The evidence is on our side. There's a lot of advocates working in a lot of places. But when that's all gone, there's going to be a lot of students that remain vulnerable to bad law and policy. And I'm really excited to learn about the adapting of good programs, evidence-based programs, because students are going to need those in particular places. And here are our websites, and thank you very much.
Okay, we do have a few minutes for questions, and I think that you can direct your questions to any of the panelists up here. Does anybody have a question? Yes, I see one back there.
It is a core component. We do not recommend that anybody drop that out of the curriculum. All of the facilitators in Hawaii that we have trained are including the condom demonstration and condom practice. We have had a few issues initially. In one intermediate school, in the first semester in which Making Proud Choices was taught, the school principal allowed the condom demonstration but would not allow the students to practice. However, after seeing the success of the curriculum the first time around, ever since then we've been allowed to do the entire curriculum in its fully, including the condom demonstrations. And there have been very few, if any, complaints from parents. All of the student, there is a permission form that is a passive permission form that is sent home to all of the parents prior to teaching the curriculum that gives them the an opportunity to opt out if they do not want their children to participate. And there have been very few parents who have chosen to opt out, well under 1%.
Okay, I see another one in the back there.
Okay. Well, some of our adaptations were no cost, simple things like changing names and settings in the role plays. We received funding from three sources to do the actual video. The CDC provided part of the funding, and we got grants from two local foundations. Also, by working with Hawaii Student Television, which was a nonprofit organization, they contributed about $10,000 in in-kind costs, and the overall cost of the video was considerably lower than it would have been if we had used a commercial producer. And I have to say, Hawaii Student Television, when we first talked to them, they said, do you want to do the Cadillac version or the Ford version of this? And we said, give us price quotes on both. Well, the Cadillac version was $200,000. We actually paid just over $36,000 to produce our video, which is 14 minutes long. We were fortunate in getting two local celebrities, one of whom you saw, Cutmaster Spaz. They donated their time for the video. So we kept the costs as low as we reasonably could. This is a nonprofit video. It didn't have some of the bells and whistles. I think about the only criticism I've heard of it was from one person who said, as a person who has a tattoo, I can tell which tattoos in the scene are real and which are the temporary tattoos, because we could not afford a professional makeup artist.
Okay, I see another question back there.
Did everyone hear what I just said? Okay, sorry. So
you should repeat the question.
Oh, so the question was on the congressional hearing that we had on abstinence-only till marriage programs in April. It was in Representative Henry Waxman's committee, the Government Oversight and Reform Committee on the House side. And the Republicans had one witness. His name is Stan Weed. He is the champion evaluator of abstinence-only until marriage programs. He works from his basement in Virginia. And he has one peer-reviewed paper published. If you'd like to know why we disagree with that, you can go to CECAS's website. There's a lot of problems with the content of the actual curriculum that he reviewed called Reasonable Reasons to Wait. And we had a variety of witnesses, including the president of IOM Institute of Medicine, Dr. John Santelli spoke, and the president of APHA. We had a representative from APHA. So it was a very distinguished public health panel that spoke saying these programs don't work. And what we've been able to use that is just to build the evidence, and a lot of states have been able to, you know, use that as a talking point. So there's no specific action steps from that, but it certainly adds to the evidence, it adds to our talking points as advocates, and we're definitely using that. Something, it took a long time to get there.
Promote more
Well, first of all, comprehensive sex ed is overwhelmingly supported by parents. So while abortion is a polemic, you know, polemical issue, and people are really on both sides, people really agree on comprehensive sex ed. Evangelical parents overwhelmingly support comprehensive sex ed being taught in public schools. It's just not an issue that it's easy for people to move on. We have both Republican and Democratic supporters. We are considering changing that 8-point definition, but changing it would be eliminating it because there's nothing in it that's good. It really is marriage promotion. And so maybe AFLA would be something. Right now, AFLA, as it stands, it's connected to another public health program, which is not bad, and it's linked to that 8-point definition, and that could be a strategy, delinking that, so that AFLA could just be a pregnancy prevention program or a teen-parent communication program, because there's evidence-based programs to model after that. But the funding strategy that we pursue is the REAL Act to promote comprehensive sexuality education grants for state governments to apply for, much like Title V, only evidence-based. Sorry.
I saw this hand first.
I'm sorry. I live in North Carolina. And
I
recently heard of this. They're trying to get behind this legislation in North Carolina, and I'm sure you know about. You can probably describe better, but I'll give you a shot here. And it's this idea of offering two tracks in the school of sexuality education. One is abstinence only until marriage, and one is comprehensive. And it's kind of a path. I mean, you send home and you allow parents.
North Carolina is a really funny state. I don't mean to say that. Because the way that you use your Title V abstinence only until marriage funding is incredibly unique. It's divided per pupil, basically. And you have very specific requirements per your state law, what students have to be taught in specific grades. So I have heard about the legislation. I don't know how much it will be able to move. We were hoping that you would elect a new governor to reject Title V. I hope I just didn't break the law. Sorry. That's recorded too. Oh no. I didn't tell you to vote for anyone. Yeah, I didn't say that. Okay. I don't know any more than you do about that piece of legislation. The stance that CECAS would take would be not to have that second track and only to be able to offer that comprehensive sexuality education program. But North Carolina does teach students about condoms, so you do some you do some good things, and you know you use your Title V in some places you use the Title V abstinence only until marriage programs to do good things. So you're using bad money to do good things. So I hear. So that's why we have to replace the bad funding.
Okay.
I don't know, but we have CECAS guidelines that were developed with a large panel of people who do know. Our New York office is dedicated to providing education and guidelines. CECAS does not create curriculum, but we have our third edition of guidelines, and they're used all around the country by different state governments to develop their guidelines or other curricula. So if you see me afterwards, I'll give you a link to that.
A few years ago, about 5 years ago, we were doing some work in the area of commercial sexual exploitation of youth. And we did focus groups with a number of intermediate and high school students. And one of the things we heard, I will never forget this one, I was with a group of seventh graders who were in a peer education program, and they did tutoring for children in the nearby elementary school. And one of the comments that one of the girls made was when we talked about teaching young people about commercial sex work and how to avoid being recruited, one of them said, you know, seventh grade is too late. You really need to start in the elementary school. And then another of them added, You know, those fifth graders down the street, they know so much more than we did at their age.
Okay. We really just have about 1 minute left, so I'll go ahead and take that last question.
At the congressional hearing in April, two young people spoke, and they were the most eloquent speakers on the panel. One, Shelby Knox, actually experienced abstinence only until marriage programming in Texas from her pastor, and has then became an advocate against the programming. And then Max Siegel, a second advocate, he actually experienced abstinence only until marriage programming when he was in high school and contracted HIV. And he didn't have any kind of skills or knowledge to know how to ask his partner to use a condom during his first sexual experience. He became an advocate. I mean, there's a lot of other things involved, but it didn't certainly prepare him. Youth make amazing advocates. In Florida, the Healthy Teens Act that I mentioned, where they're going to their second legislative session. In their first legislative session, they didn't expect it to move at all, but they were able to get it out of one committee because youth went into a Republican woman's office, representative's office, and told them about their personal experience and what they were hearing from their friends, which was not accurate, including that after you have sex, if you sit in a cap full of bleach, that will prevent you from getting pregnant. Well, upon hearing this, this representative, Lisa Carlson, voted to pass the Healthy Teens Act. So I can tell you that, and we can all be offended, but if a young person tells a representative or a legislator that, that can be the deal breaker, and or the deal maker, actually. So the Healthy Teens campaign of Florida, that youth, it's a youth-centered campaign. I encourage you to use look at their website. I think it's healthyteensflorida.org. They have a lot of web videos that they've created with youth, and they always engage youth at the Capitol level.
Okay, and that concludes our session. Thank you all for coming.
No, I've only been working there for a month. I was in New Orleans. Capitulane, and I'm working at the Public Health Institute. You don't know what it is?
Yeah.
What do you do?
Well, I'm an education prevention specialist. I'm a fellow, but I work in Durham.
Okay.
I don't know why the
conversation was so good. I don't know. We were trying to get a prevention specialist at LPHI, but my name wasn't on that stuff. So, I mean, I was.
I think you did get one. Maybe 2 years ago.
Like our evaluation.
I don't think we did.
No, maybe not.
I know we were trying to get one with the STEPS program, and now the STEPS program's over.
Okay. I don't know why either, but
anyway.
And so what are you doing now?
I'm their senior director of survey research. So they do a big survey of state public health. So that's going to be kind of my baby. They did it in 2007. I'm going to be doing the continuing year. But, you know, all the other surveys that they do of state health officers to find out how state health is set up, how it's carried out, how it works, all of that.
And where is the
I'm in D.C., ASCO's in Arlington.
Okay. Well, and I think you're talking about developing guidelines
for best practices.
For best practices. Yes. Is that like to decide what is a best practice or to decide which best practice is?
To decide what is the best practice.
Okay. Do you have any efforts on it? I work with local on the right now. One of the things I hear from like community-based organizations and even the local health department is there's so many evidence-based practices out there. I'm here to know where to start. I don't know how to identify which is the best one for me or my population.
In what area are you talking about?
Sexual health. Yeah. Well, adolescent health in general.
Yeah.
I mean, risk behavior reduction.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know of anything like that. I mean, it seems to me that, well, I mean, I was thinking of some criteria that I would use to choose among them, but even if you do that, you know, like what will my community tolerate and, you know, what can I get community support for, that sort of thing, you still have to know what all the programs are. You know, you have to understand them to be able to choose. It's way too time consuming.
I mean, community-based organizations don't have
the yeah, you can't do
to
that.
Do that.
Right.
You know, and so I see this real disconnect between what's happening kind of at the state and national level and then what's actually happening at the local level, because people are, at least in my case, at least where I am in Durham, and even when you are supporting, it's, you know, people are taking bits and pieces of different activities.
Right, and then you lose the fidelity.
You lose the fidelity, and therefore you lose the effectiveness.
Right.
You can't lose the effectiveness.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, I guess that's good. Yeah, nice talking to you too.
We didn't know each other before. Take care.
Okay. Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
You just came in at the very end there, right?
Yeah.
I was out in the bathroom.
Is that where you were?
I'm not really right. And she is here because
they're loading her. Always a housekeeping thing. You know, yeah, have a few cups of coffee, and then that makes me thirsty to have a few glasses of water, and then I'm like, tangentially connected, but he and I each were friends with this one woman that had nothing to do with our groups of friends at all, and we didn't even know.
Oh, sure,
go ahead. We didn't even know that we each other knew her. You know what I mean? She was like this random person, and she had fibrosis, so Mark kind of bonded with her about that. Anyway, we never saw her again after college, and we only learned about 10 years later that we both knew her. And